amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. My name's Steve W. In the stock market this week, Nvidia made it above the 2 trillion mark. The Bank of England said that interest rates were still some way off, and Elon Musk is now suing Sam Altman for basically trying to make money, as far as I can tell. But we haven't got time to talk about any of those things. I'm joined this week by Steve D. We've got more interesting things to talk about. Steve, how are you, and how's your week been?
I'm a bit bunged up, Steve. You could probably hear this one at home. I have a maybe slightly gravelly voice than usual, which is not a very gravelly voice to start with. I've had flu. I've been off work on Wednesday, Thursday, and then I've managed to catch something else and was ill on Friday as well. So I've not been feeling too great, and that doesn't mean I've put much effort into the show either, unfortunately, because I've been sat there laid on my deathbed for the vast majority of it with a screaming baby who's just had a second round of vaccines. So and being exceptionally fussy with the milk. So yeah, I've had an okay week in stock, Steve, though that's not been too bad. You were saying that the market was up less than I was. I'm up about 1.25% on the week, which is a bit of a surprise to me because it's felt like a sluggish week, but I am finishing the week at all-time highs. Deckers has just been admitted into the or added to the S&P 500. And with the Supermicro computer, and that, I think that goes through on the 15th, so the little bit of excitement around that has pushed Deckers into the 100% club for me. So that's, I think, last month or a month and a half ago, I said to you who was going to be first to 100. Was it going to be ASML or Adyen? Well, it was quite clearly ASML, ASML or Deckers. And ASML was quite clearly in front, but then Deckers not far behind. So I'm quite happy with that, Steve. Been a decent week in terms of stocks. My REITs have done well. Four Corners, about 5.65%. Alexandria's done 4.33%. Mid-American, 3.18%. And Prologis has done about 1.5%. So all of those, really happy with them. They were my four, red stocks. Prologis is very green. But those three, my main concerns. And they seem to be going pretty well, Steve. How about you? How's your portfolio done?
Less well this week. So we'll start with portfolio stuff for me. My portfolio is down this week. I thought it was going to be a week. I said to you on Monday, I think, that if I don't outperform this week, I'm basically quitting. And that was when Berkshire and Premarket had jumped about 5%. Big company. It takes a lot for it to do that, especially the way it operates and kind of grinds forward. But it gave back all of that pretty much on the day, and then more during the rest of the week, actually. It's down 3.5% on the week compared to an S&P 500. That is up, well, a bit, basically. It's up 0.87, so nearly a percent. FTSE 100 down 0.3, and the VWRL up 0.63. NASDAQ up more than those, but I don't usually cover that one myself. I'm down 0.29%, and Berkshire being my biggest holding by quite some margin. I thought it would get it would be pulling that higher with the 5%, and if it had stayed there, it'd probably be a different story, but, you know, ifs and so on. Outside the market, I've been okay. It's been mad busy at work. Littleton's not been so good, though. He's had another round of croup, which is quite uncomfortable for him. It probably sounds, I think for most of the week, it sounded worse than it probably was, in that he was running around happily enough, but sounding quite wheezy and like he was in discomfort without showing any kind of visible signs of that happening. But yeah, he appears to be coming through the worst of that, although he had an absolute meltdown last night. We think probably because he was hungry in the night and just refused to go back to sleep. But overall, reasonable week. There are always going to be down weeks. I think I had quite a few that were going all right up until this point, and starting to think I should look at it weekly more often. I've now given up on that idea, but I will keep doing it so I can say on this show what's been going on where with my various portfolio bits.
Very interesting. Sorry to hear that about your boy. I think we've had the fussiness that comes with the sort of vaccines. The one of them, just for people who don't know, is absolutely deadly. It's just like gel stuff that gets squirted into the mouth. It's kind of a sweet gel, and basically, if you were to get that into your hands and put your hands in your mouth, you get essentially explosive diarrhea. It's a rotavirus vaccine. So they have it twice. So it's in the first round and second round of vaccines that they have. And yeah, so basically every time you pick a dummy out of the mouth, you're like, you know, you're aware it's like a, you know, an object of great harm to your body. So you have to be very, very careful with it. So yeah, they make her a little bit fussy. They give her a poorly tummy, but she seems to be coming out the other side of that now. Nothing, a little bit of cowpole. Can't help. Premium bond, Steve. I checked them because we may as well talk about that. It was premium bond day today, and premium bonds suck, and I don't want to talk about them. Do you have premium bonds, Steve? Or
no, I sold them all to buy Realty Income, as I sort of notified this show back when we had like three of us several hundred years ago now. In point of fact of how that's gone, from a total return perspective and a capital appreciation perspective, it's gone very badly. From a kind of income perspective, which I thought would be sort of good and sort of cool, it's gone, I would say, poorly, which is better than really badly, which is how it's gone from a capital appreciation perspective. So I sold a bunch of premium bonds about what feels like about 3 years ago, maybe slightly less than that, because I was fed up of winning roughly 75 quid every 2 years. So I'd win a £25 thing, usually sort of twice in 1 year and once in the next, and calculated the return on that and realised it was pretty terrible, to be honest. And I thought, what would be cool is that if I could get my way to by compounding through something, and I eventually selected Realty Income after some actual research, not just the fact that they pay a monthly dividend, to be my weapon of choice for this, and thought, if I can compound my way to getting 25 quid a month just by using that capital that I've got there, that would be cool, right? Getting sort of what I would get three times a 2 year span every month. And I worked out how long I thought that would take. And I have horrendously got that wrong, despite having a boost from the market pushing the price down, making my reinvesting more effective. The thing that really hasn't worked for me is currency exchanges. So actually, my dividend's gone basically nowhere as the UK pound proceeds to scupper all of this by strengthening gradually against a dollar, which means that every time they push up their dividend, and they have been pushing it up by very small amounts, and I reinvest to buy about what feels like nearly half a share at the moment, not quite that, then the next month's dividend seems to be basically the same as the previous month's dividend. So that's currently not worked as well as I'd expected. To be honest, I'm not in a position where I need the income just yet. And I'm okay with the idea that the stake is still what it is and will keep generating cash and so on and so forth through REITs for quite a long time to come. But it's fair to say that hasn't worked out as well as I thought it might, despite the fact that I have, not got any premium bonds, because I also think they're rubbish, even if you can find something less effective to put your money into.
Yeah, my only reason is tax. So, if I can get the return, even anywhere near to the return that they promise on their on their headline rate, it's better than me putting it into a high end savings account, because I'm generally over the savings limit. Because we put our mortgage over payments money, because there's no use paying it off at the moment when your mortgage is just over 1%. We put all that into a pot earning interest, and the amount that we've managed to save now attracts. It's over our personal savings allowance for both of us. So that's what I use them for. It's purely a tax thing. My wife has some in, and she's never won. She's had about £100 in for 30 years and never won. We're 35, 36, 30, however old we are. She's had him in a long time, since she was born, and never won. She's recently added quite a bit more to it. And I think she's done like a fifth of the way to filling it, and she's still never won. So she thinks it's rubbish. She's at the point of saying, like, I'd sooner pay the tax, you know what I mean, and then have at least a 3% return or whatever. So I guess that's something. But Steve, shall we shuffle on? What have you consumed this week?
This week, like most of the investing world, I have been paying attention to the Berkshire Hathaway letter. First one since, of course, Charlie Munger's passing at the start of this year. And there was a nice piece on Charlie and his influence over Warren Buffett, over Berkshire Hathaway. The two are not quite the same thing, but they may as well be. And the ways in which things might be different now that he's not there anymore. I read that carefully. I saw a lot of it being reposted on social media and various comments that are worth this, that and the other, all of them fairly sensible from what I could see. But then I kind of got further into the letter and tried to look at the bits that matter for the business going forward. I mean, arguably, the absence of Charlie Munger matters for the business going forward, but looking more at the kind of subsidiaries and what they're up to. And reports this in, it coincides with the end of year earnings report for Berkshire, so I guess this probably doubles as that, although it'd be much quicker than it normally would. Downturns in both Railroad and Berkshire Hathaway Energy, which are two of the larger subsidiaries behind insurance. And Buffett's commentary on those was interesting in both cases. I was especially interested in the utilities commentary. Utility stocks are pretty much, well, they're one of the few things that as a sector you can buy low at the moment. There's bits and pieces you can buy low elsewhere. So stuff like Pfizer is down, or well down, because declining COVID vaccine sales, and various companies have various company specific things going on with them. But it's utilities in general, and US utilities in general, that are currently looking like their share prices have been heading down and to the right for a little bit. And that as a whole is interesting, I guess, if you're a dividend investor, because utilities usually make pretty good dividend stocks. They have pretty usually reliable, predictable earnings. A lot of them feature on Dividend Aristocrat or Dividend King or Dividend like Warlord lists or whatever they are. But they, for good reasons, they are durable, predictable businesses. They don't grow by much, but they, as Buffett says with Berkshire Hathaway Energy, we're not going to get very rich by doing that, but we are going to find ways to keep making incrementally more money. We're not going to get very poor either. His commentary on this was quite, I want to say bearish. That's not really a term that he'd use, I think, but I mean, he talked about what I got from it was echoes of his comments on banks from the shareholder meeting last year. So Berkshire sold a load of banks, including JP Morgan, mostly due to uncertainty over regulation, pointing out that, look, these things are subject to regulation set by people who are not themselves. Those people may have various interests. They may or may not be in the interests of the banks. Don't like the way this is heading. Get out, basically. And I thought very similar things came through in the utilities commentary here, in the way utilities businesses work is that they're allowed a rate of return on their assets. They, you know, put quite a lot of capital into providing things that the country, the state, the people need, like transmission infrastructure and power generation and so on. And in return, they're allowed to make some money for a regulated amount that's protected against stuff like inflation and so on. But BHE has been hit by quite a few heavy losses from things like forest fires and so on. And this is not uncommon across the utilities industry, especially in warmer parts of the country where they, well, where increasing electric storms have been getting generating forest fires, and they can be huge liabilities associated with that. We saw PG&E a couple of years ago on the hook for massive liabilities for this. The way to sort it is undergrounding, but that's incredibly expensive. And Buffett, for the first time, talked quite bearishly on regulation, which is both the big kind of strength and the big risk for utilities. No one can take your business away, but there's a real sense in which no competitor, sorry, can take your business away, but someone who's not a competitor could leave you in a terrible position, specifically a regulator. Steve, I know you had a bit of a look at this. Did anything else from the letter stand out to you?
The bit I really enjoyed, though, Steve, was the bit you've already really covered. So it was the bit on where because it's been long misunderstood, I think, what Charlie Munger's role was at the enterprise. I think a lot of people have said that, well, he influenced he influenced the way Buffett invested, and he's been there as a sort of a sounding board for Warren Buffett's investments. But Warren basically explained that he was a lot more than that, and the way he explained it as essentially people can remember, I think it's the phrase is something along the lines of, people remember the architect but they don't remember the builder. And he said he was basically insinuating that Charlie was the builder of of Berkshire Hathaway, and it was a really nice, and you knew it would be. He's obviously had time to think about how to word this, and obviously it's a long time friend, so there'll be you know, a lot of time spent thinking, you know, the correct way to word it. But it was a really, really lovely piece of the just a really lovely piece on obviously somebody who'd been a long time friend and mentor and business partner. So yeah, we'll link it in the description for everybody who wants to read it. But yeah, highly rate, even if you don't normally read the Berkshire Letters, I mean you should, but if you don't normally, you should definitely read that section just to get an understanding of what Charlie meant to Warren and to Berkshire Hathaway. So there was a bit I really enjoyed, Steve. Yeah, interesting the bit on the regulator's been sort of a friend and a foe. I think I can totally see that point. I think when you think about it, just sat back in your chair with your arms behind your head, you could probably see that as a case. You know, the regulators are there to ensure that you you know, you're doing business correctly, I guess, in that sector, because the prices of energy provided are you know, is really important to the citizens, that it remains sort of stable and affordable. The opposite of that is true, in that for providing that stable and affordable electricity, you get the you know, the stability of really no new entrants into your market. So it's sort of a double-edged sword in a way, isn't it? I think you know, you've got to be careful of what goes on, but you are protected, you know, against potential problems, obviously, so long as you keep up with the regulation.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we think about moats and barriers to entry and that kind of thing, it's very tempting to think that with utilities, look, basically they're extremely, extremely, extremely high. No one else can come and set up a utilities business next to yours and start underpricing you and taking away your business or whatever. Morningstar, when they think about it, and I think I'm quite critical of their way of thinking about moats a lot of the time, but I think they have a good thing here. They don't think any US utility has a wide moat. And the reason being, okay, no competitor can set up next to you pretty much by law, but equally someone can take away your business without you doing anything. A regulator can just say, nope, you can't make that much money. And that's not a sign of a business that, it's a sign of a business whose durability is out of its hands, which is a bit like not having a moat, effectively. And I think that they make a good point there, where they say, look, the best moats are in the utilities sector are narrow at best, because you have agreements that protect these things, but they are subject to constant review, and that review is not yours. And Berkshire is, I think, calling attention to that a little bit. That might be part of the reason that not Berkshire's attention to it, but general difficulties across the sector might be part of the reason that those stocks are down at the moment. Anyway, Steve, what have you been consuming this week? Something, hopefully not something else, reading.
Well, I have two things. One thing is not my consumption of the week, but I'm going to give it an honorary mention. So I showed it to you just off air, Steve, but I've been starting to read Nicol Pelroff's This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. And it's a book about cybersecurity. So she, it was a sort of espionage and sabotage writer, a reporter for the New York Times. And she currently serves as an advisor to the Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. It's a really, really interesting book on her time at the New York Times, her interviews, the things, the people she spoke to, and the story of the sort of cyber weapons market, and the sort of urgent threat that's faced, you know, by the world if we can't, you know, bring it to heel. So really interesting book. It's a Bloomsbury book, Steve. I suppose I better mention that I am a Bloomsbury shareholder, so you know, it's not that reason that I am recommending it. I'm really, really enjoying it so far, and I'm only a short way in. I think it's going to be a fascinating read. But my consumption for the week, my actual consumption, is a podcast I really dislike, but this is actually a decent episode. I think I dislike it just because the guy is so scouse. He's the most scouse person ever, and he's really difficult for me to understand. But it's the On The Money podcast from Interactive Investor, and the episode was out on the 29th of February. It was recommended to us in the Discord by Prism, and it's called What You Can Learn From How ISA Millionaires Made Their Fortunes. And yeah, it's an interesting episode where they've spoken to a few people who are now ISA millionaires, and I think one's in the 60s and one's in their 80s, and ask them what they did, essentially. There's also a load of stats and information in there from Interactive Investor said that they've now broke the 1,000 ISA millionaires number on their platform. So it is quite interesting. They've got like a load of stats. I said at the time when I watched it on the Discord that I'm not sure what the takeaway is. I don't think there's anything you can learn from it, particularly. These people have investment trusts, and one of them got lucky on Nvidia. I think he made $100,000 on Nvidia. So I'm not sure there's any key takeaways there that you're gonna go and action on your portfolio. And I'm not sure their key takeaway is a particularly good one either, when they started saying, well, it was diversified investment trusts that did it. I'm not sure that's necessarily true. I think it was diversified investment trusts that did it for these guys, but not necessarily that will do it going forward. I think they had Fundsmith in there, was one of the investment trusts that they had, which obviously has had really stellar performance, but may not have stellar performance going forward. And that tends to happen with investment trusts. Most people tend to pile in. Yeah, I'm not really sure what the takeaways was. And also they sort of ignored the fact that ETFs are a lot more commonplace now, and a lot more people would have probably hit the millionaire status if they would have just bought ETFs back when they were, when they were starting out, rather than dabbling in stocks and bits and pieces. I mean, one of the guys has 80 stocks, I think he says, which is, I don't know how he keeps up with 80 stocks. I think that's a nuisance. So yeah, it's an interesting thing, full of stats. And if you want to check it out, I'll put a link in the description. It's quite short. It's only about, I think, 25 minutes long max, but it's an interesting listen, and I think it's probably worth your time this week.
When you said with your first one you'd showed it to me off air, right, my mind went back to, I was like, what was the last thing he sent me? And I thought, have you consumed your bloody Decker's position or something? Is that what you're about to tell me about? The last thing you sent me on WhatsApp, I think, was a screenshot of your Decker's investment. But no, you did show me that on the call before we started talking about it. So in every way, talking your own book, or at least your own book publishing company for the time being. Cybersecurity is one of those things that's really interesting. I both think I ought to try and learn more about it, and that it would also take me prohibitively long to become an expert in it. Maybe that's an interesting place to start, right? Stuff that's kind of adjacent to it, rather than here is a course on cybersecurity, here is what all these words mean, here is how they all fit together, here is how to assess it, and then you've got to try and get on to assessing competitive advantages and so on. I won't talk myself down on this too much, given what we've got coming up on the show in a little bit, but I guess it's good to be trying to get adjacent to some of these things. On the Money podcast, I haven't listened to that show, and you telling me you hate it makes me, well, slightly less likely to than I would otherwise, but I do like these kind of shows very much, the kind of how people got to, not necessarily millionaire, but I quite like it with sort of more famous investors, of how they got started, stuff as well. And I'm always interested in the kind of relationship between how they invest or operate now that they are millionaires, billionaires even in some cases, and how they operated when they got to that point. Buffett, going back to him, is a good example of starting off with things that were obvious, cigar butts and so on, before switching into kind of growthy things. And there's always a good question, I think, to be asked, that is, okay, is the way that they invest now, when people copy what they're doing now, because what they do is undoubtedly intelligent, different to what they were doing and should have been doing when they were kind of on the make and on the way up? Is it the case that if you've switched over to defending and you say, well, see, look, Bill Gates owns this thing or something, therefore I should be owning this thing, doesn't automatically follow. He's in a different time of life and may have different ambitions to the likes of me. Almost certainly does. But so it's really interesting to hear about what people did to kind of get there. And maybe the key takeaway is that there isn't really a kind of a special key takeaway thing of buy this or invest like this or go growth or go value or go dividend or go combination or just buy an ETF and sit there. Or maybe the answer is just get lucky in this kind of case. But working out how to put yourself in the right position to get lucky in the stock market involves, there are things you can do to give yourself a better and worse chance of being lucky. You put yourself in the right places, you give things a chance to fall your way. You put yourself in the wrong places, whatever you think that looks like, and you greatly reduce your chances of getting there. That's how it worked a little while ago. That bit's still how it works. Question is figuring out what that looks like for people who are not, what did you say, 60 and 80 in terms of age.
Yeah, yeah. You've got to be in it to win it. That's what they used to say, wasn't it? That was the old game show phrase. And I think that's the case here. It's like, you know, you'd be lucky if you won £1 million on the premium bonds. But if you didn't have any premium bonds, you've got no chance of being lucky, have you? So I think that's probably the takeaway there. Steve, shall we shuffle on to talk about chase changes?
Let's do it. My plan for getting rich involves spending as much money as I can and then getting 1% of it back in cashback, Steve. How about you?
Well, that was my plan, but Chase are changing the way they're doing their cashback, Steve. So a couple of weeks ago, we spoke about Trading 212's debit card and that it was offering a 0.5% cashback, and there was no sort of minimum amounts that you needed to put in to trigger that 0.5% cashback. And we said it was quite an attractive offer, but we did say that Chase was offering 1%. So it was a bit moot if that was the only point you was going for. But now Chase has changed all its rules, Steve. So I've been there a very long time, so I've been through a few iterations of this 1% cashback. You were just getting it on any spending, and then it was if you put £500 into the account, you would get 1% back, which was very easy to do, to be honest with you. You could put the £500 in and take it straight back out, and you would get the 1%. Or I was putting the £500 into my Chase and then depositing it into Trading 212 as my monthly deposit. That was activating it. Now Chase want you to put in £1,500 a month, so they're really chasing the people who would pay their salary into it, and that becomes, I mean, it becomes infinitely more difficult to do. But I was reading Money Saving Expert today, and they would suggest that schemes like this have worked before, where you could put £1,500 in and take £1,000 out straight away. Or you could, you know, have your salary taken and paid it, and then transfer it to wherever you normally get your salary paid. Or you can put in £500, take it out, put £500 in, take it out, put £500 in, and you know, and that would also work. So I don't know, Steve. To me, this is like if you've ever read the book Nudge by Richard Thaler. I think his name is Richard. We'll go with Thaler. It's the opposite of a nudge. It's really, I think, trying to stop the people who are just using Chase for the 1% cashback, which is essentially me, from, you know, just fleecing them for this 1% cashback. I, to be honest with you, have thought for a while that this was potentially going to go away, mainly because platform fees in the UK, the fee that a bank gets for letting you use their card, is usually halved with Visa or MasterCard, and the platform fee is not 1%. So this is like a loss leader for Chase, especially when you think about the administration of things like chargebacks and things like that. Having a customer service department, blah, 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 blah. Obviously, they're going to make some money back by skimming off the savings rate, which they failed to keep up with the base rate. They're now about 1.5% behind. They probably have been making money off people, but yeah, this 1% has been a bit of a loss leader. And at 1500, it just seems to be a little bit more faffing around for me, Steve. So I'm probably not going to go ahead with it. So I think it's pushing me towards, you know, using the Trading 212 card for the cashback, and it's not going to be much, I guess, but. The other thing they've done is they've capped the top end of the cashback. So when you first started at Chase, you could it was unlimited what you could earn, and then it became £15 a month, I believe, and now it's sticking at £15 a month. So I don't know, Steve. It seems like a lot of hoops to jump through, and I appreciate it is just like a case of transferring in £500 three times and transferring out. But to me, I think my sort of banking relationship with Chase is probably going to come to an end. I don't want to leave Monzo because I'm an investor in Monzo, and I quite like to try and, you know, line their pockets through platform fees and things like that if I can. But if someone's going to give me 1% cash back, it doesn't make sense for me to spend through Monzo. But if somebody's going to make me jump through hoops to get it, then I'm more likely to just either go back to Monzo or, you know, try out this Trading 212 card and see what happens. Do you have any thoughts on that, Steve?
Yeah, a few. One is probably the biggest risk in the banking sector, and a surefire sign that you've got your business wrong is that Steve starts showing up and trying to take you for free money. So this might be a sign that Chase is actually making quite a good move here. I'm basically waiting to hear that bank profits are all down because they gave away too much basically free money to a guy from Hull who transferred his current account to them for 30 seconds and then shifted it off to somewhere else again. But I am also of the view that this is not enough to attract me over. It probably wasn't before, in fairness, so they're not really losing in my case. I do have the Chase account because they're one of the ones where I sort of think they're in the market for being a candidate for being interesting. So at the moment, my kind of cash savings, as it were, my emergency fund, basically, are with a combination of Marcus, who have a slightly higher rate because I've got a bonus rate attached to it, and I can put... theory, I can put unlimited amounts. I can't put unlimited amounts into anything, but they will pay that rate on whatever I can deposit in there. And I'm spending out of NatWest and double rounding up into my 6% thing that I talked about at the start of the year. That's going quite well, actually. I've got all kinds of hacks that I would talk about if this was more of a personal finance show than it actually is. But nothing much is going to cause me to stop changing from there. The setup from Chase is now, as you say, $1,500 in, and you can basically earn 1% back on it if you spend it out of their account. You could transfer it in and transfer it out again, but I mean, from their perspective, it doesn't make much difference, I guess, in the sense of they won't pay you any cash back if you just transfer it out again somewhere. You have to spend something from their account to get cash back. I don't really care. I think 1% probably isn't quite enough to make it interesting to me on what I spend. I think my move for the moment is to keep trying to round stuff or double round stuff up into my emergency fund, freeing a part of my other emergency fund, as it were, and then getting myself to the point where I try and pull back my spending a bit, I think, or become a bit more mindful of my spending and sit tight. I like Chase as a bank. They had me, my kind of involvement with it goes back quite a long way. I was on user testing the website and I was one of the people asked to sort of test out a beta of that. I gave them some thoughts and advice that they systematically ignored. But I now recognize the app that I was being asked to look at. It wasn't under the name of Chase, or I wasn't told who it was. The only thing I said was that where Monzo has pots, they had separate accounts that you can set up for different things. That's very welcome. I said because I'd heard about Wells Fargo and fake accounts and stuff, I was wary about setting up different accounts like that. And they said, nah, I would do it as separate accounts. Thanks. I think it's a good app. I quite like it. I quite like having a Chase account. If I get tempted, I might try and attach a couple of direct debits to it and then transfer it to somebody else for some free money. But that's about the extent to which I'm interested, I think.
One of the interesting little tidbits, Steve, is that you can, those little current accounts that it lets you set up extra versions of, you can use them in your current account switching service to get the switching bonuses. So if you wanted to open four or five extra little current accounts with Chase in the app, you can fire them all off in every direction, providing you meet the minimum requirements to get switching bonuses at all the other you know, all the other banks you want to go to. Is usually a nice grand or 1500 quid in your back pocket to do a bit of switching. Obviously you get a little hit to your credit score, but who cares. Steve, lastly before we move on to stocks, trading 212 yep. lifted their interest rate up to 5.2% this week. Has that enticed you to think about saving with them? Is that enticed you to think about maybe selling that Realty Income position and taking the 5.2% interest there?
No, but not because of anything that's wrong with 5.2%. The reason it hasn't enticed me to do anything is because it's only up from about 5, I think. And realistically, I was sticking as much cash as I could into there anyway until I found opportunities to whack it into stocks. Trading 212 with 5%, admittedly not a fixed 5%. As you can tell, it's not a fixed 5%. It just went up. But 5%, I was already interested anyway in trading 212. 5.2% doesn't cause me to do anything I otherwise wouldn't have done. Likewise, 1% cashback from Chase doesn't cause me to do anything I wouldn't otherwise have done. I'm still kind of landing cash in that account when I think I have it available to do. It's not quite tempting me to do anything silly, which is kind of nice because I don't want tempting into doing something silly with my spare change, emergency fund, cash lying around or whatever. I'm definitely not sitting the emergency fund in there, mostly because I don't trust me enough to not go and do something that I ought not to with it. But 5.2%. It keeps getting a bit nicer, doesn't it? And as you pointed out this week, I think on the 212 forum, probably on Twitter and anywhere else that you thought I might be looking, Free Trader coming for them though, Steve. Free Trader, you can't get to 5% without getting to 1%, and Free Trader on their way.
Yeah, Free Trade have hit back, Steve, I called it, with an incredible 1% on your first £1,000 that you deposit into the account, Steve. So, I mean, what an incredible offer. Their customers must be over the moon.
It's nice to see these companies doing what they can, isn't it?
Yeah, the only thing that really sort of like troubles me about that is the FCA have said to all of the brokers, you need to start sharing more of your interest with your customers, which is why all these rates have gone up, and why people like Hargreaves and II and all the other sort of rubbish UK brokers are sort of scuppering around to try and figure out how they're going to make any money. They've basically... seem to be skating around that rule. I mean, the base rate's in the fives and Free Trade are offering one. That seems to me not compliant with the rule. And I would be interested to see what their take on that is. Because I think it's pretty scummy, to be honest. I think you shouldn't have to pay a fee every month to access a higher interest rate with the broker. That doesn't sit very well with me. In fact, none of Free Trade's decisions sit very well with me. I don't think you should have to pay to access stocks. I don't think you should have to pay to have, to access an interest account like that. I'm not really sure that I agree with a lot of Free Trade's decisions, which is why I'm not a customer there. Steve, stocks?
No. Yeah, let's talk about stocks. Okay, let's start with Rightmove then, who reported their earnings yesterday. It's now March the 2nd. They reported on March 1st, which was Friday. The stock went down about 5%, and I wrote a nice piece, what I thought was a nice piece for Motley Fool. It took me way too long to write it because it took me, I would say, longer than it ought to have to realise that I'd actually clicked on the 2022 results, because they hadn't updated the link on their thing to link you to the most recent one. So I spent ages digesting this set of full year results thinking, firstly, is that guy still CEO? I thought they'd handed it over anyway, and these look, that's weird. I didn't think that was happening in the property market. Anyway, I got to the right set eventually and made sense of what I was looking at. Here's what's happened with Rightmove. Stock went down about 4% and then recovered to actually be slightly up by the end of the day, which surprised me. I thought the initial drop made more sense than the subsequent recovery. See what you think. Revenue was $364 million, which was 10% higher than the previous year. Operating income, this is full year, by the way, was $285 million, which was 7% higher than the previous year. And earnings per share were 24.5p, which was 5% higher than the previous year. We know about Rightmove. We've talked about Rightmove before, but just for those that haven't thought about it that much or haven't had a chance to listen to our wonderful insights on the subject, it's a really attractive business when it comes to metrics. It doesn't have much in the way of assets. Its margins are huge. It doesn't cost them anything much to add customers, so it grows like a weed without taking any capital to do so. No manufacturing, no real kind of property or plant or anything like that. Staff costs are their main costs, but they're not that high. Free cash flow margins are insane. So, very attractive business from all of those perspectives. You expect it to do good things when it comes to numbers. What's been going on with them recently? I think it was October last year, around October, November. CoStar, which is a kind of US version of Rightmove, but seven times their size, decided they were going to acquire a company called On The Market, which is like a UK version of Rightmove, but like 7% of their size. And this gives Rightmove a bit of a headache because CoStar has said, look, we're coming for your massive margins here and we are going to outspend you, basically, to try and get to them. And that's not that difficult if you're the size of CoStar. Or at least On The Market were saying they were going to do that. I guess it still remains to be seen a little bit. But Rightmove's huge margins and the possibility for underpricing gives you something to think about for the first time in basically forever. The stock plunged on that news, actually, back in October, November. It's since pretty much all the way recovered, as the market said, yeah, it's the UK, nothing ever really changes, Rightmove will carry on being fine. So I previously thought maybe the market was factoring in that about right, and I now think it's probably underpricing that risk. So what in the report do you want to look at to help you work out whether or not that risk is something you should be taking seriously? Answer is Rightmove's moat, but there isn't a moat section in the report. You need to work out what their kind of competitive advantage comes from. And their competitive advantage comes from a two-sided network effect of a sort. It's where buyers go because that's where houses are for sale, and it's where people advertise because that's where buyers go. So the more buyers you have, the more advertisers you have. The more advertisers you have, the more buyers you attract, and things reinforce nicely. Breaking into that will be tricky. You will need to convince people to advertise with you, even though you don't have any sellers. Buyers, and you will need to attract buyers there even before people have decided to advertise with you. So the basically what matters here is size and scale. Do you want to see Rightmove? You want to see Rightmove having as many buyers and sellers as possible on its platform. And its membership, i.e., its advertiser base, was down by 1%. You can put that down to a cyclical thing if you like. And the number of minutes, so the time people buyers were looking at that, was down from 15.4 billion to as opposed to 16.3 billion. It reached 15.4. So with competition on the way, you don't want to be seeing things taking a backward step in what looks like your company's moat. Now, it's not been an easy year for the property market. Prices have annoyingly remained stable, even though the cost of debt has gone up, which ought to be slowing activity. The reason for that is that lower supply has been coming online, so there's less stuff for sale. People are less incentivized to move because with higher mortgage costs, they're going to end up paying more to move to the same size house, which is sort of less attractive, I imagine. You can put a fair bit down to that, I think, and maybe the market during the course of the day thought, yeah, we can kind of put a fair bit down to that. But the main kind of concern I saw with this was number of advertisers and buyers shrinking, which is why I think the stock kind of dropped off a little bit. I mean, the numbers look fine to me, 10%, 7%, 5%, and then there's adjusted versions of these that are slightly more impressive in each case. But a PE of around 20 or so for a company with nearly no debt, returning large amounts of dividends and buybacks, they are pretty active in that regard in trying to move their share price higher. Steve, what did you think of this report?
Largely fine in a cooled off market is what I would say from this. I'm not particularly worried about the slight decline in membership, and the site traffic at 15.4 billion being less than last year is pretty much what I would have expected, based on the you know, how hot the property market went to and from, essentially. So there was not a lot of anything that I looked at here and thought, well, this is bad. I'm impressed that revenue grew. I'm impressed that underlying EPS grew. I'm impressed that they've grown the dividend. And I'm impressed that the site traffic was as good as it was. So no concerns here whatsoever. One of the things that was highlighted to me was what you also spoke about was the CoStar deal for on the market. I think that's going to be a proper bust, Steve. I can't tell you how stupid a deal I think that is. If CoStar was serious about it, you just get your money out and buy Rightmove, because Rightmove is already in the hearts and minds of the people. When people want to look at a house, they don't go to On The Market. They don't go to any of the other crap. They go to Rightmove, and you know, that's where people find their next house. It is on my. I've got no. Don't want to move, Steve. I've got no intent of moving whatsoever ever again. I still got the Rightmove app on my phone, and I still occasionally have a look around to see what is there. If my colleagues are talking about moving, we're always on the Rightmove app or the Rightmove website looking at them. We don't bother with the other places, and that's the problem that CoStar have got. They've got to get people to be bothered about the other services, and nobody's been able to do that yet. And the reason is, it's not because Rightmove is is cheaper, or Rightmove is particularly even any better than the others. It's just that people use it. And there's a saying in business that you've got to fish where the fish are. And for people like estate agents, the fish are definitely on Rightmove. So CoStar can come in and say, look, we will come and list on us, and we'll do it for a tenth of the price. Well, it ain't going to sell, because people don't use On The Market. So eventually people will have to cross promote to Rightmove, and then eventually their house will sell. Rightmove is the link between consumers and sellers. buyers and sellers in the housing market, and I just don't see that link being broken, especially by a brand which has a crappy name and crappy sort of logo and everything, and that horrible
"There are thousands of new properties to buy or rent"
advert. I just don't see it. I cannot see it being usurped here, Steve.
Working backwards through those, I don't remember that advert, but I'll go and look it up now that you mentioned it. I basically, when I heard about this, I thought, I don't know who those people are on the market, to be honest with you. I know about Rightmove fairly obviously as someone who moved house fairly recently. I actually also know about Zoopla because for some reason my wife seemed to naturally gravitate to that platform rather than Rightmove and just found it a bit more user-friendly. And I mean, I'm aware that Zoopla is the next, by anyone's standard, Zoopla is the next biggest competition to Rightmove. It's a very distant second, but there's clear daylight between Rightmove and Zoopla, and then clear daylight between Zoopla and everybody else from what I can see of it. Like you, I also, whenever I see a house near me for sale, it's partly habit now, partly nosiness. Sort of break out the Rightmove app and say, oh, I wonder what that's going for. I'm not buying it. I'm not even thinking about buying it. And I'm definitely not selling this place. And wife and I have agreed that basically the time we leave here is in a box. And then Alison Litlin can work out what he wants to do with it. But yeah, that's clearly the plan for CoStar. Charge advertisers a lot less, charge estate agencies a lot less. Find a way to bring them in and then buyers will follow. But the real question is, I mean, can they? Will buyers follow? They're talking about spending a lot to try and break into this, but this is going to be basically what tests out Rightmove's moat. And if you think the decline in membership, i.e. advertisers, estate agents and the like, and sort of lower minutes, i.e. buyers, is just a product of a slightly tougher market for trying to buy and sell things in, which it clearly is. And I saw by push notification that house prices were up again yesterday in the UK. As someone who's very much not in the buying market for that, but is in the owning market for that, I suppose I should think that's a good thing. It doesn't really matter to me very much that the value of a house has gone up. Maybe if I ever tried to refinance it, which I suppose is possible, but yeah, I also have the same kind of nosiness you do for prices here. The guidance looked okay. They're planning on, as far as I can tell, hiking prices by pushing up ARPA, average revenue per advertiser, to by about 100 quid or so. That will help, and they're looking for revenue growth in the sort of high single digits range again. I thought there's decent kind of cash returns coming out of this, and that might be kind of interesting, but price just a little higher than I'd like it at the moment, I think. Rightmove is one that I've owned before and sold for the reason that it never really turned into something that was ever going to be big enough to make it. The buying opportunity didn't hang around long enough, and I got to about 800 quid, and then it went up a bit, and I thought, I can't be sitting here with an 800 quid thing anymore, basically, and I can't be bothered to wait until it next kind of falls again. Don't know when that'll be.
I don't think it's too bad here, because I think they have an opportunity to quite quickly and rapidly expand revenue and top line again once the market heats up. So I think looking at today's price, we probably won't worry about that too much, you know, in a few years' time. Just to add to the other point about members dropping. So there's a few reasons why that might happen. So last year, about 20% of the sort of agency and property developers market was at risk of insolvency. So at some point, I remember reading that in July, so at some point some of them will have gone bust, which will account for some of the membership disappearing. But there's also the fact that essentially what happened was a lot of companies put the bases in of the buildings. I think I've described this before, but they put the base in, the foundations in, to avoid moving on to the new regulations, which cost quite a bit of extra expense, and then didn't actually build anything. So when property developers are putting bases in and not building anything, they don't actually sell anything, so they fall off being a member for that year for Rightmove. So less building going on, less houses for sale, less sales going through. That accounts for that membership, but all of that can change around, Steve, in a heartbeat. House prices are increasing again. Interest rates are coming down, we think. So if that happens, Steve, that's usually a pretty good sort of area for somebody like Rightmove to to crack on. And if you think that Rightmove's been able to increase prices quite successfully, obviously bringing in more revenue on less members is always a good sign that you've done pretty well. And if we get a market that starts to hot up a little bit, and they get more members in, more listings, and more revenue, with a sort of 70-odd% operating margin or whatever they've got, Steve, that very quickly disappears down to the bottom line, or goes down to the bottom line, and everything looks cheap again. So I think that's technically what's going to happen with Rightmove. Again, I think this CoStar threat is small. I think this is the kind of issue we have every time somebody big enters the market. I think we always sort of like think, oh, that could be a bit of trouble, and it often ends up being nothing. The amount of times Amazon has tried to enter things like the pharmacy market, and it never really seems to take off, apart from for their own employees, which is a strange one. So yeah, and it never really seems to put a dent in anything. So I think CoStar is in no way has the sort of spending power of a big entity coming in. It obviously has more spending power than On the Market had, but I still think On the Market finishes a distant third, and this has looked the price they're paying for On the Market. So they're paying, I think it's 150 million off the top of my head. I can't remember. It's not a lot of money. How much money are they going to want to plow into it, Steve, before they say, look, we've bought this for 150 million and we've spent, what, 500 million? On marketing to try and take serious market share of Rightmove, and it hasn't worked. Are we going to put more money in? Do they have 500 million to waste on something like that? Are they going to put 50 in? Are we seriously saying that that's going to be enough? I'm not sure, Steve. I think the competition is sort of grossly over-egged here.
We often look at this the other way around, don't we? We often look at the kind of big company off doing some sort of international expansion thing and finding it doesn't work because it's in a area that they don't know as well, because it's not their home market, and people there think differently, behave differently, so on and so forth. It's interesting thinking about this from the other way up, right? Rightmove has a lot of properties that you would think make it attractive, or a lot of properties that I, for a time, quite like to try and find, which is dominant position, niche market, which protects you from below and above, right? Dominant position means you can beat out the people that are smaller than you, which it currently does. Protection from above means that there isn't that much to take, basically, for someone who, I mean, sure, if Meta or somebody came and wanted to try and compete with them, they absolutely could outcompete them, but what is there to take is, I guess, the question for a bigger competitor here, and is it going to be worth the kind of cash that they want to put into it? Because unless they can kick Rightmove out entirely, they're not going to take all of Rightmove's stuff, but you might think that to get a decent return on your investment, you might have to. Even if you just end up sharing this market, the market might not be big enough to be a meaningful thing that you could usefully share, and we end up just competing each other out of a decent profit here. They clearly feel otherwise, but we'll see how it goes, I guess. Shall we talk about cybersecurity?
Let's do it. So I was looking at Okta's earnings. So Okta's something that we've covered a couple of times on the show. I used to own it in my main portfolio, and I've sold it. And I now only own it in my Capital Incinerator Pie. It was something that Chris Hill spoke about when he was on the show as well. I think it was one of his cybersecurity players. And he'll be pretty happy today because it's done pretty well this week. But I'll quickly run down the fourth quarter earnings, and then I'll give you the full year as well. I've got some of the business metrics, and I unfortunately haven't had a chance to listen to the call, so if you really want to listen to the call, it's there for you. So revenue came in at $605 million. That was a jump of 19%. Net income was $113 million. That's non-GAAP. That was up 117%, margin of 19%. That's up 848 basis points. Op cash flow of $174 million, that's up 129%, margin of 29%, up 1,386 basis points. Free cash flow came in at $166 million, up 131%, margin of 27%, plus 1,332 basis points. So remember, you've got to sub SBC off, I think, all of those. I think that's what they're non-gapping. In terms of full year earnings, revenue was up 22% to $2.3 billion. Non-GAAP net income was $286 million, a margin of about 13%. Op cash flow was $512 million. That was up nearly 500%, margin of 23%, up 1,800 basis points this year. And free cash flow was $489 million, up 652%, just margin of 22%. and that's up 1,811 basis points. So pretty strong performance from Okta, especially when you were listening to both Palo Alto and Fortinet's calls when they said there was potentially a little bit of cybersecurity spending fatigue around at the moment. Interesting to see that Okta is still managing 20% growth. In terms of business metrics, so remaining performance obligations was $3.4 billion. That was up 13%. Net retention rate was 111%. Customers was up to 18,950. That was up 8%. And customers spending over 100K with Okta was 4,485. That was up 14%. In terms of guidance, they said that RPO would be about $1.92 billion in the first quarter of 2025. That's plus 13%. Revenue would come in at $605 million, which was about up 17%, but flat quarter on quarter. Free cash flow would be about $151 million. They said would be about a 25% margin. And in terms of the full year guide, revenue they said would be $2.5 billion, Steve, which is only up 11%. Potentially that might be a bit of sandbagging, might be a bit soft. We'll see. And free cash flow margin they said would be about 21%. So yeah, I thought the guidance might scare the market here. It didn't. The stock rose about 30% this week. And I thought these earnings looked pretty good, Steve. Anything jumping out at you?
It looked pretty resilient, didn't it, as a set of earnings, I think, in a market that, yeah, there's a little bit of fatigue around. I think it's like, it feels like it's AI in that kind of everybody in some sort of tech adjacent field knows that they're going to have to involve themselves in this somehow. I mentioned when we talked about Palo Alto that I was sort of surprised that that people kind of dared not spend on cybersecurity. I get that you might want to pull in costs at times when business is softer, but there's things you can't pull in costs on, or you take a big risk by pulling in costs. And I think one of the good things about cybersecurity firms is that in all their pricing and the way their businesses operate and are managed, their price to customers is cheap considering the risk they offset. And that means that customers are generally going to try and keep them because the risk of a kind of security breach is huge. And if you can pay a certain amount to offset that, in Okta's case through kind of identity software, that's significantly well worth your while. Looking at that stock kind of going up fairly sharply this week, it's been up and down over the last however long, hasn't it? I mean, it's been a kind of bumpy old time for Okta. If you bought it at the top before, you're well above where you started, but that's broken through a top quite significantly recently. I mean, if you look at I'm looking at the FinViz chart, you have to kind of squint a bit to see it because there's an enormous gap and it looks like it's just gone flat towards 85 or so, and then headed quickly towards 108, which is quite the jump, actually. It feels like that's the kind of jump you see when you see a business kind of shifting over and crossing an important milestone. Do you think it's a profitability milestone that people are getting excited about?
It's pretty close to a sort of full-year profitability. Well, it is there, I suppose. It depends on how you factor in SBC as a real cost or not a real cost. Obviously, it depends if you like cash accounting or not cash accounting, I guess. But I think potentially the issue Okta's had is it's sort of lurched from being massively, massively overvalued to crisis when I think was it their own services that somebody managed to get into, which must be very embarrassing for a cybersecurity company. That is the height of embarrassment. But they've since recovered from that. They announced in the presentation that they put out that there was very sort of only minimal systems were accessed, as opposed to the initial reporting, which said that they'd have basically been able to get full access to Okta systems, which would have been that would have just been the height of embarrassment. But yeah, I think potentially, you know, that edge towards profitability is something that people are interested in. But also, this is just a very decent set of reports here with a, you know, 20% growth on a $2.3 billion company is pretty good. It's got a big runway ahead of it. It's got plenty of competition as well. But I don't think it's necessarily a big issue here. I know Thoma Bravo has been sniffing around buying up quite a lot of quite a lot of sort of cybersecurity companies, and at one point I wondered if they would be interested in taking Okta private as well, because it was less than I think it was less than 10 billion in market cap, which is around the sort of Thoma Bravo sweet spot. They were hoovering up loads of companies of that kind of size, and they haven't done it, Steve, and it's now about 17 billion. So I think that's a different kind of story. So I think it's doing okay. I think that guide is a little bit soft. I think they've probably sandbagged the guide a little bit, but it hasn't really helped. When a company sandbags a guide, the price normally goes down. And I think the market has looked at this and gone, that's definitely a sandbag. It's far too soft. And we don't believe you. And that normally leads to problems when you get to the actual report and they say, look, we did 15%, and the market is like, yeah, we were pricing in 20. And that usually sends the share price back down to somewhere in between where it was and where it is. So, I think it's a pretty interesting set of reports. I don't think there's anything really jumping out at me as saying this is a stellar performer. I don't know if it really deserved to be up 30% this week, but there's certainly nothing wrong with the report.
I don't know. I mean, if you like cash-based accounting, price to free cash flow is now about, I mean, it's a rounding error from 34. And if you think that's a company that's going to grow, a significant runway still to go, significant capacity to increase prices, people will generally sign on for this kind of thing. In terms of its particular area of cybersecurity, which is kind of identity verification stuff, I'm not sure there's much else that's that competitive with it. There are a few kind of two-factor authenticating things, but it's not stopping Okta adding people very well and growing sharply here. 34 times for something that's going to grow pretty consistently is not crazy here, and I think has a strong position against its kind of competition. As always, switching costs are pretty high, so you have some capacity to increase prices without people running away. If you go too mad with them, they might try looking elsewhere. But forward price earnings are supposed to be about 42, which for some reason that looks a lot higher to me than a 34 number. But cash-based approach for free cash flow, I thought that looked kind of reasonably all right, actually, as a sort of potential thing to have a look at, even after a quite significant 25-30% jump.
It's an operating leverage thing, isn't it? So
yeah.
You can see that in the operating cash flow and free cash flow numbers rising like obviously like nearly 20 times as much as revenue and 30 times in terms of free cash flow. So I'm not saying that that's that's what's happening exactly here, but this is one of those kind of services that the more and more customers get in, the more and more profit they should be able to realize, because it's not like they have to actually physically produce something. The software is produced essentially and is now being obviously continually developed, but it's not like they have to physically make a product which affects the operating leverage. So I don't know. It has to continue to grow. That feels like a stupid thing to say, but you have to understand that for this stock to make sense, it has to continue to grow at a decent clip for a decent rate of time. And I think there's enough in the industry as a whole for them to take a smallish market share, continue to grow, and for this to look like decent value in 10 years' time. I'm not going to buy any more of it, Steve. I've actually reduced the size of the capital incinerator again. I took it from 5 grand to 1,500 to just 500 now. I'm keeping that money to one side for my ICE deposit next year, which I think is more sensible use of the money. But people really wanted to see how it played out, so I'm just going to let it run and see. And I think that's probably my position. I'm guessing you're not buying it?
I'm probably not. I'm almost certainly not. Let's be a little bit more realistic here. You mentioned Thoma Bravo, who I also think are probably not. 18 billion, it's quite a push to try and get that private. I noticed they had to go for Everbridge, which is a company I looked at sort of around the COVID start of things. They do sort of mass notification systems and emergency warnings and that kind of thing. Their share price for Okta, I was thinking, it kind of does look like Thoma Bravo did just agree a deal to acquire them, though, right? It looks like they were trading at around the mid-80s mark, and now they've jumped with a 30-odd percent premium because Thoma Bravo, or somebody, has agreed a deal for them. That's the sort of shape you start seeing when people start announcing acquisitions, and And I guess it's worth noting then that there does seem to be a decent amount of M&A activity starting to come back through again. People are starting to acquire these, not Okta specifically, but things that made their way off to a decent start during low interest rate years and are now looking for a kind of more durable home that can perhaps look after them a bit better here as they try and battle their way towards profitability and just need a bit more to kind of get them through, or can meaningfully add to their whatever it is, distribution, client base, so on and so forth, as part of a bigger thing. It might just be that I'm seeing things a little bit, but it looks to me like M&A activity is starting to come through a little bit here.
Yeah, definitely, and the IPO market hotting up as well. Reddit obviously announcing that they wanted to do they want to do an IPO, and they've recently uprated as well to uprated the valuation. I think it was from 5 to 6.5 billion, but I can't remember exactly. That normally means that the market is starting to get a little bit of heat underneath it, which is good news for somebody like Goldman Sachs, who've been sat there twiddling the thumbs, not knowing what to do for the last sort of year and a half. So yeah, interesting to see that. I'm excited for the IPO market to hot up, because that always makes things interesting for us to look through new companies. You get sort of a little bit bored of the stale old lot you've got at the moment, and it's always nice to add a few more to it. Steve, do you have time for Croda, or do we need to disappear?
No, I'm all right to talk about Croda. Since you mentioned boring, stale, old things, we can talk about that for a bit. Croda International, FTSE 100 chemicals company that announced their earnings towards the start of this week. They have a market cap of $6.8 billion, and they're probably headquartered in Hull, because nearly everything is, or at least there's some sort of building in Hull, or at least there was fairly recently. Something, something, Hull, something, UK stock. Anyway, they make specialty chemicals rather than kind of generic ones, and they get about 33% of their business from what's called life sciences, which is a combination of agriculture and vaccines, and about 50% of their business comes out of the Europe and US, selling them into those areas. This will become important in a moment. They had a bit of a drop on their earnings, but they'd found their way back by the end of the week, a bit like Rightmove really, but unlike Rightmove, they were earlier in the week they fell and then were finding their way back up again. And I kind of scored their earnings as, or I looked across their earnings and thought of this as the good, the bad and the ugly. There's a lot of what we already knew about, as there often is with these end of year things. You're just putting the last piece in for the final 12, the bit of the 12 months. But let's start with the ugly then. So sales were down 19%, pre-tax profits were down 70%, EPS was down 74%, and it doesn't come much more ugly than some of that. But there are a couple of things you can kind of note here. So one is that these are adjusted. Unadjusted numbers, and you might want to adjust them, and I think the adjustments are, well, you might want to adjust them because they're not very good. But there are also decent reasons, I think, to adjust them in this case. They divested out their UK healthcare arm, so they are making less as a result of doing that. So you can take the pre-tax profits and the earnings per share down to being just 38% down rather than in the 70s here. A good amount of this is kind of what we already knew from a kind of cyclical downturn. That's the sort of good news, I guess. Management is maintaining that this is a cyclical downswing. They're guiding for between 5 and 10% sales growth for the year coming up, which is encouraging to see things moving in the upwards direction again. So there's maybe a sign this could be as bad as it gets, and Croda has managed to push its dividend higher for the last 29, 30 years or so, and when you get to that kind of time frame, you start looking like a company that will move your dividend forward regardless of what happens. There comes a point where you start thinking they've seen it all before. Not necessarily pandemic stuff before, but they've seen upturns and downturns and crises and threats and boom times and this and that and the other, and they've moved forward every year in dividend terms. They will do it again. It's not always the case that the way things have been is an indication of how they will be, but it is the case that sometimes you think, well, look, they've seen a lot of this before. I'm not sure why this would come to be any different. That was the good news. We might be at the bottom of the cycle. They're guiding for sales growth, and the dividend went up. Dividend is now about 2 and a bit percent, I think, which is not huge, but nothing either. The bad news is that sales growth is set to come from with lower margins, so it won't boost profits in quite the same way. It's looking for growth out of bits of its business that aren't super high margin, which means that overall margins aren't going to come through at the levels they have been. And the real question that I've had with Croda for the last as long as I've been thinking about it is, how long does this downturn last? If companies, especially these ones that are cyclical on their face, have ups and they have downs, and you can buy them on the downs and you can sell them on the ups. But the question is, how deep do the downs go and how long do they last? We spent a lot of time during COVID talking about U-shaped recoveries and V-shaped recoveries and L-shaped recoveries and hockey stick charts and all kinds of things like that. But the real question for Croda is exactly how long does this last? And the bad answer, which management gave, which I think is the correct answer, and I kind of applaud the honesty here, but their answer was, we don't know. And that's not good news and not what you want to hear. Well, I mean, it's what you want to hear if it's the truth, right? You don't want them to make something up. But it's not encouraging news for investors that they're in a downturn that may last some unspecified amount of time. The risk, I think, with Croda is that you might find you're looking at dead money for quite a while here with not much of a dividend to pull you along. I think the thing is about 40 times earnings. Those are when earnings are depressed. I would expect them to go higher. It's a 2.2% dividend. That's not amazing. Unlike Synthoma, which is another chemicals company, I don't think Croda is in any danger of going kind of bust or anything. I think the risk here is that you get lousy returns for a long time while you wait for a recovery, which I think will happen eventually. But the question is how eventually. There's a real opportunity cost of time here, and there's a real cost of sitting on dead money while other things are doing better and generating better cash flows for you. Without knowing quite when, I think inventory levels are going to come down from oversupply in cosmetics and vaccines and all those sorts of things, it's very difficult to say much about how strong an opportunity this is. I guess the natural thing I kind of compare it to a little bit is Pfizer over in the US. So vaccine demand's gone off a cliff, and that's been bad news for Pfizer. Stock is well down. Croda is more of a picks and shovels thing in that they supply different manufacturers, and you don't have to take a bet on who's going to come up with the next vaccine. With Pfizer, you have to bet it's going to be them sooner or later. The other difference with Pfizer is they've got quite a big dividend that they're paying out at the moment, and that is covered by earnings and is forecast to be covered by earnings going forward, which makes me wonder whether you get paid better to wait from them than you do from Croda, even if you might be waiting for longer. If you're getting something in the region of 6% to do so, it's perhaps worth it when the time comes, you get a big payout at the end of it. So I think I see Croda as kind of more picks and shovels, but with sort of half the payoff for being for waiting around. I didn't think there's anything terrible about this report. I didn't think there's anything we didn't really know. I expected the numbers to look ugly because inventory levels are too high. What would have been nice and what would have been helpful would be some sort of idea of how inventory levels are looking and how quickly they're going to come down. Management couldn't give that, and that's what causes me to probably not get there with this company at the moment. Steve?
I think I'm in the same place as you, really. I was doing the exact same thing while you were talking there, just looking through this and saying, well, it's 50% off its highs, but in the last 5 years, and its highs were pretty much in the middle of the last 5 years, it's made minus 0.03%. So, you know, you pretty much 5 years ago, if you bought this at 4898, it's 4898 today, and you've collected a potentially 2% dividend all the way along there. So that's been a pretty poor return. I mean, you could have sold it at the highs at 10,000, but you would have been you would have been hard pressed to do that, because that was you know, they were doing very well because of the sort of pandemic, or coming towards the back of the pandemic. They'd done very well because they were producing lipids, and lipids are used in every COVID vaccine. So that business was going very, very well for them. So you wouldn't have assumed that it was gonna downturn so quickly. I don't think anybody really thought that COVID was just gonna disappear overnight. Like it didn't disappear overnight, but the interest in it disappeared overnight. I think people got very much fatigued by it very quickly, a lot quicker than people would maybe have expected. So I think that's essentially what's happened to Croda's share price. If you look at it, you can see interest in COVID and non-interested in COVID over the last 5 years. So, yeah, I think I'm in the same sort of scenario as you. You're thinking, well, Croda looks very picks and shovelies to me. They look like they're doing things that, people need. People want to, you know, buy at certain times of the year. But then Pfizer is the one to me that I look at and think, you know, we did this with Bristol-Myers Squibb, Steve. We looked at Bristol-Myers Squibb and thought, look, there's this wall of earnings coming in the future. We don't know an awful lot about the pipeline. We're trying our best to understand it. People who are smarter than us are telling us it's a good pipeline. They acquired this company that everybody thought had the best pipeline in the industry. And, you know, when that eventually comes through, you know, that'll do very well. And I look at Pfizer and I think, well, they've just acquired Seattle Genetics. I think it's genetics, isn't it? It might be biotech. I'm not entirely sure. Seagen, isn't it? Yeah. And they had what everybody said was a very good pipeline. They had a very high share price. They've paid much of a premium for it. And potentially that could be the same sort of scenario to me as, you know, as what happened at Bristol-Myers. It needs a little bit more thinking, but that's potentially where I'm at with it. So, yeah, I don't know, Steve. This is a fine set of results to me. You know, with a bit of divestment in, the only issues you've got is net debt is up from $295 million to $537 million. That's a pretty big jump, but they have bought a company in the middle there. I sort of look at this company and think it's fine at $6.84 billion. I wonder if some of the bigger American kind of chemical outfits are looking at Croda thinking, well, at $6.84 billion, we pay $8 billion for it maybe, and we get a lot, you know, a decent amount of expansion there. You know, we could potentially find some really good synergies. And I wonder if that's good value to them, Steve. There's been a sort of a swathe of EU and American companies taking over British companies at what we would say is a premium. But because they're trading so low, it's not really a premium. I think this PE ratio is potentially a little bit false, as you say, because of the drop in pre-tax profit. I wonder if this is just another one of those decent British companies that's going to get taken out on something that we would probably say is cheap, you know, at some point in the future.
The most recent acquisition I heard about, or acquisition talk I heard about, was Direct Line, which is a FTSE 250 insurer. And does not fit into the category, in my view anyway, of decent British companies that get taken out. I think it's a terrible British company that's getting taken out. Actually, I haven't been impressed by Direct Line for ages in insurance metrics. But back to Croda, I think you would need to find pretty good synergies. I'm not saying anyone could. It would be impossible for anyone to find good synergies here between themselves and Croda, but I sort of think I don't have any value add from a synergy perspective, and that makes it... Right now, I think it's in the kind of situation where, when I think about, if I really couldn't find anything to buy, and there have been times in the market where I thought I can't find anything to buy, would I be happy buying this and just waiting around? Yeah, probably. I'd be okay with that idea of finding something at a cyclical low that I think will endure pretty well, and then wait it out, basically. But that's not the situation I feel like I'm in at the moment. I've got things that I do want to buy, and I want to buy more than this. And that kind of puts it on the, I suppose, bottom of the buy list. I wouldn't complain if anyone said, look, I can't see a better opportunity, I'm going to buy this and just wait it out. I'd say, okay, fair enough. That doesn't sound like a crazy thing to me to be doing. It's not attractive enough to me at the moment. I prefer Pfizer in this. I haven't bought that either, but the more I look at it, the more I get tempted to start trying to do something there. I noticed that what they're doing in the future of COVID vaccines seems like actually quite an intelligent move to me. Their plan is to try and develop a kind of combined flu and COVID jab that you can stick into people's arms. Demand for flu jabs, at least over here, seems to be sort of reasonably high, and that's fairly resistant. And if people think, I can't be bothered to go and get another COVID jab, they don't work, there's still loads of COVID stuff around everywhere, I've had enough of this stuff, lump it in with a flu jab and they might take it, and that might be helpful. And actually, it might make the combined thing more attractive. That seems to me like actually a pretty intelligent thing to do if you can. We get to the point of then that if you can, and neither of us is a pharma specialist, but my general view on this is that if the thing trades low enough, that doesn't matter. It needs to trade very, very low, and with a big enough margin of safety to offset the stuff you don't know, which in my case about vaccines and pharma is quite a lot, to be honest. But there's a chance Pfizer might just be low enough with enough of a margin of safety to cover that, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that completely. That is a good idea as well. I think lumping them together and obviously charging a little bit more, you know, two vaccines for the price of one kind of thing. I think that's probably a really good move. The company I was thinking of, Steve, which when we were talking about buyouts was Wincant. Is it Wincant? the haulage firm, they got a buyout offer from private equity GXO, I think it's private equity, and it was a 20-odd% premium, $762 million. And I was listening to John Stepek. He said, if you don't start loving UK equities, well, other people will, and they'll start buying them on the cheap. And I sort of do and don't worry about that. I'm not too bothered about haulage companies and this and that being taken over. But eventually it comes to the point where you're thinking, well, how many UK-run UK companies are we going to end up with? And I think there is something in that comment. But Steve, appreciate we've been an hour and 18. Do you want to wrap us up?
We have, yep. But that's our show. Wait and see what we've acquired for next week. Thank you very much for listening. We've been the Playing Footsie Show, brought to you in association with Trading 212, and we will see you next time.